And welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am Chip Patterson, joined today so that we can review the dual A-Days, Alabama-Auburn, and some of the rest of the SEC, wrapping up spring practice, joined by Mr. Jerry Hinnon. Jerry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great, Chip. It's always awesome to be on the podcast.
Yeah, we've got a nice little SEC-centric show for you, and I know we really don't do a good job of providing SEC content, so you know we got to give them their chance here to talk a little bit.
It's a league that's really under the radar.
It is, especially at CBS
football, especially in the off season.
Yes, but this past Saturday, Alabama and Auburn each drew more than 70,000 people out to their spring game. Only Penn State has drawn more this year. I'm not a big believer in spring game attendance, but clearly people care, so we're going to spend some time talking about it. Before we do, Jerry's going to help me run down news and notes, like we do a lot of times on this show, talking a little Mike's Live SEC schedule debate. We will discuss some fast casual food chains. That's not casual fast food chains. That is fast casual food chains. Some TV schedules, as well as the always evolving sort of the revolving carousel of transfers with some players going in and out. And before we get started, Jerry, I just want to just pitch it in general for the 2014 spring. What has been your favorite either spring game promotion or spring game event?
Here's my favorite story from spring. It comes out of Kansas, where if you're paying attention in our updating sort of live blog almost with updates a couple of Saturdays back, Blair Kirkhoff of the Kansas City Star tweeted the events from Kansas's spring game, where Charlie Weiss had put into a plan into action in which the starters were on one team, the reserves were on the other team, and the idea was the score would be reversed at halftime, so we would be able to see if the starters could overcome what was surely going to be, you know, a marked deficit at halftime after playing against the second string
right
for the first 30 minutes. That plan was foiled when the reserves actually took a 7-0 lead into halftime after outgaining the starters by about 2-1 margin, and went ahead on a late touchdown pass into halftime ahead 7-0, which necessitated Weiss apparently scrapping the score switch plan. He did not switch the score back to give the starters the lead at halftime.
He allowed
to be fair to the Jayhawks, the starters did come back and win the game 20-10. But that is my favorite tidbit from spring practice.
And was Cozart playing first string with the eventual starting quarterback? Yes. Was Cozart, and he was starting for the starters then?
Yes, that was my understanding.
Oh man, nearly went 0-1.
Because I remember I saw the name of the quarterback who completed the only touchdown in the first half, and I'm pretty sure it was not Cozart.
I liked over at Arizona, they had a promotion where if you could out-throw an existing Arizona quarterback, you could win $250.
Wow.
Which I thought was especially...
You'd think there would be like a former high school baseball player, you know, on campus somewhere who would have a shot. Maybe not be able to do it, but would have a shot.
Well, Rich Rod has 5 or 6 quarterbacks in that Arizona quarterback competition, so uh-huh. I determined that if anyone lost that competition, they were just automatically out. This is just this is just another level to the Arizona quarterback competition. If you get outthrown by a fan, you're going to tight end. I'm really sorry. You're going to be a slot wide receiver.
Well, you know, you have to find some way of going about culling the quarterbacking herd, you know.
They also, if you could kick a 50-yard field goal, you could win $500. Arizona's just got all that Pac-12 money, I guess.
That's right.
All right, well, let's jump into some of these news and notes brought to you by your company's call here. If you would like to sponsor this, you're more than welcome to. Right now, it's just us. Mike Slives spoke to the Associated Press sports editors on Monday in Alabama, sharing some details regarding the ongoing SEC schedule debate. We are at a point now where from 2016 forward, the SEC schedule needs to be set, and there are sort of two debates. Number one, whether or not to join the Pac-12, Big 12, and Big 10 with 9 conference games or to remain at 8. And then the other being whether or not to maintain the primary traditional crossover rivalries, where in the SEC East, Florida's traditional crossover is LSU, and every single year they play. Jerry, this is a topic that you have written about literally for years at CBSSports.com. Yes. So I wanted to ask, attack this sort of from two angles. Number one, what do you think will happen? And then number two, putting on your fan pants, what would you like to see happen for just sort of the overall experience of SEC football?
Yeah. Well, I'll answer number two first, and that's of the four options we've been given. Like, according to this live, we've got either 8 games, like you said, 8 games with crossovers, 8 games without, 9 games with crossovers, 9 without. What I would like to see would be a 9-game league schedule with the permanent crossover rivalries intact. I can't really envision an SEC. To me, getting rid of the permanent crossover rivalries, you either have to compromise and like retain Auburn, Georgia, and Alabama, Tennessee, and you have everybody else rotate, or you maintain the permanent crossover rivalries. Like, if Auburn and Georgia aren't playing and Alabama and Tennessee aren't playing every year, something to me is wrong.
Right.
Like, you know, and I realize that we've already lost so many incredible college football rivalries on an annual basis. Kansas, Missouri, Texas, Texas A&M, you know, Oklahoma, Nebraska, so many others. And the SEC, fortunately, has really mostly been spared that, not just within the conference, but outside of conference as well. Florida still plays Florida State. South Carolina still plays Clemson. Georgia still plays Georgia Tech. But, you know, this is sort of where the rubber is meeting the road. And I think if you're the SEC, you really lose something if you lose Auburn and Georgia and Alabama, Tennessee in particular. And even some of the other rivalries, you know, Vanderbilt and Ole Miss, you know, they've played every year since 1970. A lot of LSU and Florida fans don't want to play each other anymore because they're LSU in Florida and they feel like it's an unfair scheduling quirk because, you know, Tennessee's kind of dropped off the map a little bit. But there's also a lot of fans there that like playing a game that's been played annually since the divisional split and even for much longer than that, actually. You know, these are important games to the lifeblood of the league. And so for me, it's just not acceptable to put together a schedule without those crossover rivalries. And then as far as 8 games or 9 games, to me it's easy, 9 games. You know, if you're – there's no way to make a 14-team, 2-division setup really work in an 8-game format. Like Alabama and Florida, which are not permanent crossover rivals, would play twice every, I think, 16 years. That's not good enough. Alabama and Florida need to play more often than that. I want 9 games with permanent crossover opponents.
What would you think about? So, what do you think is going to happen? First part, if you were to make it, if you were just make a prediction, what seems to be either from your combination of gut feeling, hunch, just sort of reading around. What do you think?
Yeah, first of all, it's twice every 12 years. Like my math was wrong. Math was never my strong suit in school, and apparently still not. And twice every 12 years, you would have rotate through 6 non-permanent opponents, and you'd get through the rotation in 12 years. So twice every 12 years, you would see Alabama play Florida or Auburn play Tennessee or Georgia play LSU. You know, those two teams have played some classics in recent years. And, you know, if you're talking about an 8-game schedule with crossovers, then you're going to see that. Congratulations, like, you know, less than a decade. What I think is going to happen, though, is that we're going to see exactly that. I do think for at least a few years right now, I just don't feel like the sentiment is there in the SEC to move to a 9-game schedule. That's where college football as a whole is trending. The Big Ten's doing it, obviously. The Pac-12, the Big 12, you know, is doing the round robin now that they've only got 10 teams. But I don't feel like the SEC is really moving towards that as a league. Like, we've heard a lot of griping about it, in particular the teams I mentioned earlier that have major non-conference rivalries, Florida, Georgia, South Carolina. They don't want the burden of an extra SEC game where now you're talking about having basically 10 games,
locked in,
already locked up. Yeah. Thank you. Every single season, you're going to have your 9 SEC games. You're going to have your one big non-conference game against your rival, and then that's it. So if you're Florida or Georgia, you can't really go out and schedule a really sort of high profile non-conference game, like one of these Chick-fil-A kickoff classic kind of games, like that Georgia played against Boise. Florida, I think, is scheduled to play Miami this season. Those are the sorts of things that can't really happen if you're Florida. Like, do you really want to play 9 SEC games, Florida State at the end of the year, and then top that off with a serious non-conference game at the beginning and really play one breather the entire season? I don't really think that would be the end of the world, but in modern college football, nobody's going to agree to that. So I think for the time being, what we're going to see is an 8-game schedule with crossover rivalries and see how the SEC network fares its first couple of seasons. If it turns out that they need those extra SEC games to fill out the inventory, which there's some debate about because you're also talking about taking away an SEC home game, which would possibly be aired on that network as well in the non-conference slate. But if it turns out that TV needs those extra games, we'll get them. And if not, I don't really see them happening. We're just going to have to live with very rare meetings between Alabama, Florida, Georgia, LSU, et cetera.
Very good point about whether or not it is guaranteed, because the TV angle was always what I thought would be a reason why it's moving to 9 games.
Yeah.
But the fact is, it could, if we change that to a conference game, I don't know how the TV rights would work with that. And I guess what you're suggesting is that no one does. That's kind of still up for debate.
Right. If Vanderbilt and Ole Miss play each other, then that's one game for the SEC network, theoretically. If Vanderbilt and Ole Miss both host Patsies that particular weekend, then that's two games, possibly, for the SEC network. So, again, it's now, would you get better ratings with one Vanderbilt and Ole Miss? I would argue you would definitely get better ratings if, like I said, Alabama and Florida. I keep harping on this, but to have more of those really cross division top tier matchups that we don't see very often, I would think TV would want as many of those as they could get. But there's some, I would say, wiggle room within that argument.
Yeah. Okay. That's very good points there. Thank you, Jerry. You got that down. I don't think the SEC would go for this, but with our own Dennis Dodd began reporting on how the Big 12 and the ACC are sort of working to pass legislation that would deregulate conference championship games. Mm. And in the case of the ACC, the example that's being used is such that Clemson and Florida State have been finishing as sort of the top two teams. Only one of them can go to the conference championship game.
Yeah.
Do you see the SEC deregulating itself so that while you do need the divisions in order to structure your conference, I could see them, or I could see a conference in general, not the SEC because of the traditions, but I could see the conference tackling this problem by saying, there's going to be the one or maybe two opponents that are locked in, and then the entire rest of the schedule, the other six games, it'll be 1-6 1 year, or 3-5, like some way that it essentially rotates with blocks, so that you're seeing a new crop of teams every couple of years, but then you won't maybe play a division opponent necessarily every single year.
Yeah, that would be, if the NCAA goes for that, I definitely think the SEC would go for that as well in a heartbeat. The MAC did have a setup a couple of years ago where not everybody, they had a 7-team division and a 6-team division, and the 7-team division didn't actually play a true round robin. They played only, I think, 5 games within the division, skipped one individual intra-divisional opponent, and then played 3 against the opposite division. But they had to get an NCAA waiver for that. I'm not sure the NCAA would go for that with evenly weighted divisions. That's really in the NCAA's court. I do think if they open that window, the SEC would probably prefer to go through it. Again, nobody at the SEC wants, these Alabama-Florida-style matchups to happen twice every 12 years. They would much prefer them to be more often than that. And that would be one way they could go about it. I'm just skeptical that waiver is going to happen. We'll see.
All right. Now, we did promise you some fast casual food chain information.
That's right.
Iowa recruiting coordinator Eric Johnson announced this week that he is leaving Kirk Ferentz's staff to open a Culver's in Hendersonville, Tennessee. He'll be living in Nashville. He's worked for the Iowa football program for 15 years, multiple different coaching positions, but serving as the recruiting coordinator for the last 10. Sounds like a totally crazy move, right?
I don't really think it is. I'm pretty sure if you have the opportunity to open one of these franchises, and Culver's is a highly successful franchise in the Midwest. If you are listening and you are not familiar with it, listeners, it's a sort of the Big Ten's answer to Chick-fil-A in that sort of like regional identity, fast food-ish cuisine type of things. A little bit more formal than a Chick-fil-A.
It's fast casual.
It is. It's fast casual is the phrase that Wikipedia used. They've got some butter burgers. They've got some frozen custard. Those are the staples of the menu. I've been there. It's good stuff. And I don't think they just let anybody open one of these franchises. Like, this is, a special opportunity, I think. And if you're, an offensive coordinator, I don't think you necessarily take them up on it. But if you have been Iowa's recruiting coordinator for 10 years, and you haven't seen a whole lot of upward mobility, I think at this point, maybe you say, yeah, I'm going to go open up a Culver's.
Well, more props to you, Eric Johnson. Best of luck November 1st. That's if you cool. are in the Hendersonville, Tennessee area, you can go. And he promised Hawkeyes games will be on the television.
That may be a mistake, though.
In Hendersonville, Tennessee, to promise to play nothing but Iowa games?
Yeah, that would be a little bit weird.
All right, let's and then finally, there have been tons and tons and tons of transfers this week, hitting Ole Miss as offensive lineman Austin Golson, a former four-star prospect. It does appear that he will be on his way out. Jerry, Ole Miss, you and I have talked about them a lot. We touched on Ole Miss during our Don't Get Caught Sleeping episode from last month. And I've gone back and I've been looking at it. I read about Hugh Freeze changing all the signals and how he feels like this is a kind of a veteran group because they've all had to play young and they've kind of been there together. And I will declare, and tell me if I'm crazy, that with they get Alabama, Auburn, and Mississippi State at home, they travel to LSU and A&M. In those five games, I'm calling a 3-2 finish and a 5-3 SEC play record, a flip from their 3-5 a year ago. Yeah.
I could totally see that. I was driving the Ole Miss bandwagon last season.
Yes, you were.
I really think this sort of suits them a little bit this season. Going into last year, there was some talk about, it wasn't just me, discussing them in sleeper terms. I think it was Colin Cowherd, if I remember correctly, who said he thought they could be a 10-win team, which, at times they looked like they could be. They went to Texas and pounded the Longhorns, who ended up being a bowl team. They're a terrible team.
Decimated by injuries on the defensive end.
Absolutely. Like, really, the issue was on the defensive side of the ball. When we talk about this Golson transfer, and it does, he said that it wasn't a definite decision yet, but he also really strongly made it sound like that was the direction he was going. Hugh Freeze had already given him the okay to explore his transfer options. So I think at this point it's pretty unlikely that he returns to Ole Miss, which, means they've got two returning starters on the offensive line. Of their tackles they're expecting to go to war with in the fall, they only had two scholarship tackles go through spring practice that are going to be on the roster in the fall. Golson was one of them. Obviously, he's probably not going to be there now. They may end up starting a JUCO transfer, just slot him right in at right tackle. So there are some issues there. But, I kind of feel like Hugh Freeze on the offensive side of the ball is going to be able to figure things out. I think he has a lot of savvy, both himself and on his coaching staff. I think there's some reasonable talent there. even left over on the offensive line. When you've got Laramie Tunsil, you've got, you know, at least one very large building block for a successful line, even if it isn't the deepest. I'm not worried about Ole Miss's offense. It's going to come down to that defense, and if it can take steps forward from what really was a disappointing 2013, that unit really should have been better, had a lot of players back from 2012, and just didn't take the step forward, especially in the secondary. I was expecting it to. So it really should be better on the defensive side of the ball. And if that happens, depth or no depth, I think Ole Miss can definitely sort of maybe fulfill those sleeper aspirations season late.
All right, now we are going to move into your backyard. Alabama and Auburn both host their A-Days. Has that ever become an issue of squabbling among Alabama or Auburn fans? Or
who has the real A-Day?
Yeah, yeah. Our state becomes a fight in every state across the country. So what is the A-Day? Is that people actually complain about that?
No, that's a good question, and one I haven't really heard from. Auburn and Alabama folks don't really share much of anything, but apparently, you know, they seem to be happy sharing the designation A-Day. I'm guessing because, you know, they've both been calling their spring games that for a long, long time. So I don't think there's necessarily any recent ownership of the term one way or the other.
All right, so let's start with Auburn.
Yeah.
From what I saw, Nick Marshall looks great. Corey Grant's still a threat to score every time he hits the outside. Cameron Artis Payne seems to be between the tackles. You did have Sammy Coates. Now you add JUCO star Duke Williams. I don't see any reason why Auburn's offense isn't one of the best, if not the best, in the SEC again.
No, Auburn is going to be roughly the same team they were last year. They're going to come out, hang up 35 to 42, you know, maybe even more points, and then ask their defense basically to hold on and force the opposing offenses to execute well enough to put up 35, 42 points if they want to win the game. Right now, there's no real holes, it looks like, in Auburn's offense. Of course, you know, it's A-Day. Auburn puts all the first string on one team and the second string on the other, so not a whole lot of defensive resistance. But if you watch the game, Nick Marshall did look to have improved his accuracy. Duke Williams, you mentioned, looked absolutely 100% the real deal. There's one particular touchdown where Marshall threw pretty much a perfectly thrown fade to the back corner of the end zone, and Williams went up and got it. And it's just, you know, no matter who you're playing against, it was the execution that would not have been stoppable no matter who was out there on the corner. You know, if Marshall throws like that and Williams makes a play on the ball like that, it doesn't matter whether it's Auburn's second string corner or Vernon Hargreaves out there, it's going to be a touchdown. So at this point, the questions for Auburn's offense coming into the spring were, could they replace Greg Robinson at left tackle? If you've read Jeremy Fowler's excellent story on Sean Coleman, the left tackle who's overcome leukemia actually to be apparently, you know, Auburn's starting left tackle. He looked very good in the spring practice. The other questions are, you know, how can Marshall actually improve as a passer? That seems to be a yes. And could Williams emerge as sort of the second target to take some of the heat off of Sammy Coates? That looks to be a positive too. On paper right now, you know, it doesn't look to be an offense with any holes on it. Now, you know, the defense still has holes all over the place. Auburn's not going to get all the breaks that they had last season. But it doesn't look right now that last season is going to be a fluke either.
What, all right, so now we're moving over to that defensive side of the ball, where I agree there are several concerns that I would like you to address, but then there's also some things that I'm kind of excited about. But let's start with the concerns. What stands out to you, either positions of need where things need to get firmed up a little bit, or just sort of the ways that Ellis Johnson, a proven coach in this league, has continued to have to work with some good recruits, but to sort of piece together a defense that will not only stop your Ole Miss of the SEC West, but also LSU and Alabama.
Yeah, well, Auburn's defense last season was basically a big play defense. They were going to give up a lot of yards and then just hope that Dee Ford could come up with a big sack. You know, Jermaine Whitehead maybe could come up with a big play there from safety or star. You know, Robinson Terezi had some big plays down the stretch as well. so that's the first thing Auburn has to do, is not necessarily, you know, the principal improvement for their defense has to come kind of from all over. Give up fewer yards is, you know, priority number one, which doesn't come down to one or two particular units. It's everybody sort of stepping forward and getting better. But then they also have to make sure that they don't lose those big plays. And that was kind of what was difficult about the spring. Carl Lawson struggled with some injuries. Some other defenders, especially in the secondary, struggled with injuries. And it was hard to get a read on if that big play potential is still there. I think the loss of Dee Ford could be a big one. Again, it comes down to what Carl Lawson has the potential to be, a double-digit sack kind of guy. Montrevious Adams, the five-star defensive tackle, could develop into something really special in the middle there. There's a lot of guys. Auburn plays a lot of players on defense. They rotate in and out a pretty good bit. But they still, without Ford, they need to prove that they have a star somewhere in there. And at linebacker in particular is a place where they missed some of that star quality last season. And Chris Frost, Casanova McKenzie look good in the spring. I don't know if they necessarily look like they were ready to take that sort of Dee Ford type next step.
Ellis Johnson sounded very frustrated and echoed much of what you said regarding the injuries and how tough it has made them in terms of planning. As a lot of guys, just sort of with little knick-knack injuries, you know, they felt like if they knew what you can do and you're injured at all, they were going to put them on the side. But something came out of that that was very, very interesting. Because of depth issues, they actually started working with defensive tackle Montrevious Adams and defensive tackle Gabe Wright at defensive end. And it initially started just to sort of fill a depth concern, but now Gabe Wright is calling this the Rhino package, and Ellis Johnson has mentioned that it could really be something that they're going to use against a team like Alabama or a team like LSU that really wants to run the ball down your throat. And if you've got a 295-pound defensive end, that lets you be able to go up against the Quanjos, you know, go up against those massive offensive linemen that are trying to run it right at you.
Yeah, we'll see.
You don't believe this? Oh, man. I was so excited. This is why I come to Jerry, because Jerry's going to actually be able to hit the to blow the charm off of the news.
Let me just say, my personal reaction to that, Chip, is we'll see exactly how much use this actually gets in the fall, because to me, if you line up Gabe Wright and Montrevious Adams at defensive end, you're begging for some sort of, you know, play action pass, because it's going to be really, really difficult to get a pass rush through the quarterback without bringing a blitz. So we'll see. It's an interesting wrinkle. I credit Johnson and the staff for being willing to, you know, sort of experiment. And we certainly have to give credit to Gabe Wright for his Twitter handle. Wright, who wears number 90, goes by the Twitter handle 90Rhino on Twitter, which is far and away the best Auburn athlete Twitter handle out there. So, you know, credit for all of that. I'm just in a little bit wait and see mode. I'll say I'm much more convinced by Duke Williams at this stage than I am the Rhino package.
Yeah, and Carl Lawson, hate that he was not able to play a lot more, because that's a very, very big part. He just wasn't an every down player last year. He seemed like
not quite. Well, he was a freshman. You know, he's a five-star. He's an incredible athlete, but he's still a freshman. And Auburn, you know, almost nobody was an every down player for Auburn's defense last season. This year, if he's healthy, I think he can really sort of he's the number one candidate to take that D4 kind of step, but he's got to be healthy.
Moving over to Tuscaloosa, two very just sort of plastered across the top of all the headlines, of course, is replacing A.J. McCarron. When you have a starting quarterback that is there for so long and that successful, his replacement is going to be a big storyline. A lot of people tend to believe that Jacob Coker, the transfer from Florida State, who is not with the team yet, is going to be somebody who could step in. Blake Sims did not exactly grasp that role at all this spring. And the new offense, under the direction of new offensive coordinator Lane Kiffin, while the players have been telling reporters about some of the ways that they like it, whether it's spread the ball around to some playmakers, didn't exactly show up either. I took no concern in that, just knowing how bland and vanilla both Kiffin and Saban would want to keep that for a nationally televised spring game.
Yeah, you know, it's, you have to give credit to Saban for saying the right things about Blake Sims. He said he did very well in the pre-spring game scrimmages, which apparently he did. The stats were very nice. He said, you know, that wasn't really the sort of situation. We didn't really gear the offense in ways that would have helped Sims. You know, basically made it sound for all the world like it wasn't a big deal that Sims went 13 of 30 and threw two ugly-looking interceptions before he threw a very late touchdown pass. And basically, for all the world, did not look like somebody who is ready to step in as the starting quarterback at Alabama. I think, you know, again, irony here is that this was the situation Auburn was in last season, where Gus Malzahn said the right things about Kyle Frazier and Jonathan Wallace. But you could also just tell that, you know, he expected Marshall to come in and take over as the starting quarterback. I think Alabama's in the same boat. I think Blake Sims has had a good spring. I don't think he has had the sort of spring necessary to hang on to the starting quarterback job again at Alabama. Because, again, you know, there's always, you know, the two sides of the coin. Maybe the offense didn't look great, but the defense, you know, even though they've lost, you know, as they do every single season, you know, a fair number of key contributors, C.J. Mosley sort of principal among them. You know, this is an Alabama defense. It's going to be outstanding. It's going to be one of the best in the country. It's going to be a lockdown unit, particularly against the run. The front seven is nasty, as always. D.J. Petway probably isn't going to be even going to be a starter, and he maybe was the best player on the field at 8A. So, you know, Alabama can't afford to waste the season with, you know, a backup quality quarterback on the field. Like, the stakes are too high for them. If Jacob Coker is anything like what he's been built to be, he's going to be the starting quarterback for this team.
Because there's so much talent. I mean, right. I really like the Amari Cooper, Chris Black, Christian Jones, and sort of late in the season last year, O.J. Howard is starting to look like really, like, you have maybe a handful of tight ends that are going to stand out every college football season,
yeah.
And he looks like he's going to be one of them.
No, he. I think if Howard had been draft eligible, I think his potential is such that he would have gone on the first day of the draft if he'd come out like this past year. He's an absolute athletic freak. Alabama's receiving core is, you know, you don't usually think of Alabama as the sort of team that really emphasizes the passing game, but their receiving core is as good as any in the country this coming season. As you point out, Amari Cooper, you know, is already a big leg up, assuming he stays healthy this season. But then, you know, Chris Black basically has had everybody talking for months. You know, and Howard is just a monster at the tight end position. Christian Jones, you know, remember that brief moment at the beginning of last season when he was a Heisman candidate? He had the three touchdowns against Virginia Tech, and everybody was saying, you know, he was like your dark horse.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking about just an absolutely loaded set of targets for whoever ends up being the quarterback. And again, I just don't think at this point Blake Sims has shown enough to say, well, you know, he's going to be able to make the most of that.
And not to mention T.J. Yeldon, Derrick Henry, and Kenyon Drake.
That's all that's in the backfield.
Arguably, you've got one of the best groups of wide receivers and running backs. If that offensive line can gel, and that's really sort of been my only note, not just for Alabama's sake, but looking back at Kiffin's USC teams where he held those play calling duties for a lot of the seasons, when there was bad offensive line play, things broke down. You know, that happened in 2013. It happened when Barkley got injured. But, you know, when there's a solid offensive line, you know, those USC offenses at their peak could average, you know, they were top 10, top 15 offenses that were very much trying to spread the ball around. And I can see how that could work here at Alabama. Again, you know, just need that quarterback and the offensive line to fall into place.
Absolutely. The offensive line, I think, is really the question mark across the entire Alabama team that nobody's really talking about. You look, you know, at the, you know, sort of projected lineup. You've got Ari Quanjo in there. They're replacing, you know, Chad Kelly's going to be the starting center. You've got a couple of guys who usually what Alabama's done in the Nick Saban era has been to plug in guys very early in their career. They bring in the, you know, five-star, top-of-the-line recruits Or maybe they find a Chance Wormack or a Barrett Jones in there, and they step in pretty much right away. You don't have a case where you have players who sort of bide their time for 2-3 years and then step into the starting lineup, which is really kind of what we're seeing a lot more of this year. Kwanjo, I think, is going to be either a redshirt junior, maybe a senior. I forget exactly, but he's been there for a while. Some of the other guys that are stepping up have been there for a while. There doesn't seem to be that DJ Fluker, Cyrus Kwanjo type of, just all-world recruit who's immediately stepping in until Cameron Robinson actually had been kind of on the sidelines for the whole spring and then ended up starting A-Day. That's sort of the thing that makes you think, that sort of unsettled situation where, maybe the upper-end talent on this Alabama line isn't quite what we've seen in the past. I don't think it would matters a whole heck of a lot when you're talking about the skill talent that they've got. But when you're aiming for a national championship, and Alabama most certainly is, it's something you have to consider.
All right, so on the defensive side of the ball, you already mentioned DJ Pettway. Is Tony Brown going to be able to come in and contribute and shore up the defensive backfield and the cornerback position really sort of in particular was one of the spots where you saw that the cracks kind of in the foundation was my phrase last year. What's your general outlook and feeling? I don't have a great grasp of what to expect from Kirby Smart's 2014 defense. Who's going to dominate on the defensive line for them?
I like Brandon Ivory a lot. It's a guy who doesn't get a whole lot of hype, and I think, he played for Alabama a lot last year in the middle of that line. I think he's going to be outstanding. In the front seven, Reggie Ragland and Trey DePriest are the linebackers I would keep an eye on. DePriest in particular, he's from Ohio. Urban Meyer just has to absolutely be kicking himself he couldn't keep that kid home, because I think he's, I don't know if he's going to quite be C.J. Mosley, but he's going to be really, really good. Xavier Dixon's another guy who maybe steps up and takes that Adrian Hubbard, I think, outside passing role, pass rushing role, I should say. The talent is there. It's Alabama. They're not going to lack for talent when you're talking about stuff in the front seven. It is a cornerback where I do think they still have to worry about a little bit. Eddie Jackson, tearing his ACLs, that's a pretty big deal. They've got, decent players at corner, but last year's, probably best, cover guy was Dion Ballou, and he's gone. excuse me. Anyways, they've got new guys out there. They've got Cyrus Jackson, Cyrus Jones, and, Tony Brown, I think the five-star recruit from Texas. I think he's got a chance to start. He played a pretty good bit during their A-Day, looked extremely smooth, extremely sharp, got off to a little bit of a rocky off-field career with his arrest in February. But that, was kind of not a major charge, and there were some witnesses disputing what happened there anyway. I would not be surprised at all if by, say, week 5 or 6 of the season, Tony Brown is getting the start. And it would surprise me if the Alabama corners don't take at least a minor step forward, but they still shape up to me to be the weak link on the Alabama defense.
All right, as we sit here, I'm going to send you out with this one. April 22nd, 2014, who do you think wins the SEC West?
Oh, man. I'll have to take a much longer look at the schedules particularly, but my guess would be Alabama again, just because I think that defense is going to be even better than it was last year. I think the offense is going to be consistent enough. I think Coker, I don't know if he's going to be quite, there's a lot of Alabama fans that are talking him up as a Cam Newton type immediate transfer Heisman winner.
You don't say, really?
Yes,
that is crazy.
Alabama fans might just be slightly carried away. I don't see that happening, but I absolutely think he can be a Greg McElroy type. And there's so much skill talent around. That's really all Alabama needs there. Auburn, I think, is going to be right there. I think LSU is going to be right there. But finally, I think, it's just sort of a matter of the breaks. Like, Alabama really was good enough to win the national championship last year and just didn't get it done against Auburn. You know, when you say you've come within a 109-yard field goal return of probably playing for a national title, you're not that far off. And I think, you know, more than any other SEC West team, again, not necessarily taking a hard, hard look at it, I think they're the most likely champion at this stage.
He is Jerry Hinnan. You can follow him on Twitter at Jerry Hinnan. Follow the Ion College Football at Ion CFB. You can follow me at Chip_Patterson. Make sure you subscribe on iTunes because that is the way that you are able to get them before they hit CBSSports.com. For Jerry Hinnan, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.